and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan. This week, Kieran Deal, Dana Schwartz, and Tian Tran join me in studio to talk about the invisible work that women do and why Charlotte's Web is kind of bullshit. Plus, Alyssa Mastromonaco calls in to discuss why likability is the least likable way to assess the women running for the 2020 Democratic nomination. And, as always, the hills will die on. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. First, a little housekeeping. If you have a hill that you will die on, record a 30-second voice memo and send it to hysteria@crooked.com. You can also contact us at that email address if you'd otherwise like to get in touch. But remember that I'm not the only one who checks it. There are a few people who read the messages there. So send personalized love notes and hate mail elsewhere, please.
Hi.
You have a theme song, which I've told you about before, and now I associate it with you. When I get texts from you, like just on my phone in my free time, I picture the theme song playing. So it's a shame you can't hear it on your end because it's very apropos. Okay. So here's something that we were planning on talking about for a while, and I think we keep putting it off for a combination of the fact that things keep happening that we have to talk about that are more urgent, like what was happening in Georgia and now what's happening in other states. And also, this is such a, I don't know, I feel like the topic is a little bit of drudgery because we spend so much time thinking about it and being annoyed by it. And that's female candidate likability.
Like them, love them, what do we do?
Yeah. So likability is a barometer, an invisible barometer by which people measure female candidates only on whether or not they can ever be elected to office or deserve love, I guess. Likability, lovability. And it's something that I've noticed people are paying more critical attention to this cycle around, but they're still kind of throwing around this kind of dog whistle likability crap. When it comes to candidates like Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Amy Klobuchar. So, Alyssa, let's kind of break it down and talk about why this is such an irritating way to measure candidates and what about it is sexist. So let's start with when's the first time that you saw likability used as a barometer for a female candidate?
So, you know, it's funny, when we were talking about this, I really, like, I wanted to think about it because I didn't want to just default to something. And so I really, like, put myself in a dark room and was like, what was the first time? And I remembered, and I'm guessing that most people, like, I think that I'm probably as young as it gets for someone who would remember this. But back when Geraldine Ferraro was going to debate George Bush in the vice presidential debate in 1984. So I don't remember hearing it on the news, but I remembered my mom talking about it, in that the night before the debate, when all of the sort of, you know, pontificators and pundits were talking about what was going to happen, Vice President Bush's press secretary said that he thought that Ferraro's biggest thing to overcome would be seeming bitchy.
Okay.
And I was like, what's bitchy? You know, I was a little slow at 8. And I'm like, what's bitchy? And my mom was like, mean, someone who's mean. And I was like, well, shouldn't presidents be mean? And, you know, then fast forward to 2008 or 2007, when I am in the Obama campaign and a person who was a man told me to be careful to not come off as bitchy because people wouldn't like me and then wouldn't want to work with me. Mm-hmm. And I remember then being taken back to the Geraldine Ferraro conversation. So my life is complete. It's full circle. I've connected all of the bitch dots.
Right. Connecting all the bitch dots, I think, is very important for the modern woman.
What was your first time?
You know, it wasn't in the context of a physical candidate, but it was related to Hillary Clinton. I remember being a kid during the first Clinton term, and Hillary, obviously being a person who had her own ambitions and her own political desires and wanting to be more hands-on in the White House. And I remember her doing things. I don't remember the term likability, but I remember her responding to people not liking her by trying to act like she just loved doing typical first lady things. Like, do you remember the bake-off? The first lady cookie bake-off?
Oh my goodness. That she, I forgot that about that.
Hillary Clinton is the reason that there is a bake-off between potential first spouses during election seasons, because Hillary Clinton wanted to kind of show that she was just like a regular wife. And, you know, it sort of made me think about, when I was thinking about likability, I'm reading this book called Down Girl, which is a feminist philosophy book on misogyny. And it's really, I do not recommend it for a beach read. It is not light reading, but it's really interesting. And one of the things that they talk about in the book is that that whenever a woman deviates from what the patriarchy needs her to be, she's punished, basically, when she's not available to them, or when she doesn't defer to them. And so I think likability is an expression of, and this is going to sound again very like college freshman, but I think that likability describes the tension between what women are supposed to be and what these women are trying to be. And they're like, is that string between what she's supposed to be and what she's trying to be still intact? Is she enough of what we want a woman to be while trying to be what a woman is not supposed to be? And it's like this impossible bind that women are in when they want to run for office. And I think this cycle around, it's become kind of, I don't know. I've found it more annoying than ever. And I don't know how you feel about it, but where do you stand?
So, well, I have to say one thing, because, you know, like, you and I talk a lot about nuance. And so there was something that popped to front of mind when I was thinking about likability. And it was that when I was on the John Kerry for President campaign in 2003 and 2004, the biggest hurdle that he had to overcome was also likability. Mm-hmm. People were like, well, no, I don't want to have a beer with him. I want to have a beer with George Bush. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, like, we all need to just reassess what the fuck we mean by likability and why it maybe matters or doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But this time, I think that, you know, look, it's the first thing I saw in this cycle, I think, was that stupid article about, like, is Elizabeth Warren going to end up like Hillary Clinton? Mm-hmm. Like, what does that even mean?
Right. They're totally different.
What does that even mean? They are completely different people. And I think that that's kind of my problem with the whole, like, media addressing the issue of likability. Because what does it mean? Because Hillary and Elizabeth Warren are both very different people, save the fact they have sort of blonde hair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I think that's really interesting. And I almost think that it's a symptom of laziness and hackiness. People who are going through this dance want there to be a predictable arc to it. They want there to be a narrative to it. And they hearken back to old narratives and old assessments and old ways that things turned out. So, like, they want the story to be, okay, who's the Cinderella of this campaign? Who's the bitch? Who's the this? And I think that they go back and fill things in a way that's just like, it's boring and it's hacky, but it's also destructive, because in creating these narratives, they limit the imagination of the voter, and they decide what a leader looks like, and they decide what an upstart looks like, and they decide what a woman who's gotten too big for her britches looks like. And I think that that's what likability is. It's like asking the question is an implicit decision that this woman has, something about her doesn't, you know what? She's just a little woman, you know?
Do you know what it is? It's kind of like this field in particular. I feel like the media should just come out and be like, who's Andrea Zuckerman? Who's Kelly Taylor? Who's Donna Martin? And who's Brenda? Who's the evil brunette? Who's the smart and likable but not sexy school paper editor?
Right.
Like, and also, what's the winning combination?
Right. Well, a lot of it is people who don't ever interact with normal people trying to decide what normal people want to do. And they've decided, I think, like, it's funny just being from a small town and being from the Midwest, seeing what people on the coasts think of the people where I grew up. It's like, oh, that's interesting and totally wrong. It's like when a child who's never gone to work tries to play office. It's like, well, no, we don't send that many faxes. You know, like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, also, and to me, there is a chasm between relatability and likability. So, like, to me, I give zero fucks if someone can drink a beer. Guess what? I can't digest beer. So that person does nothing for me to be able to be like, oh my God, she can throw them back. No, what I'd like to do is put every single person running for president on a stage and ask them if they know what the price of fucking gallon of milk is. Mm-hmm. You know, like to me, that is what, like, I'd like to see someone be able to talk like real people talk. And guess what? Beer is not actually just code for real people talk. It's like, she's likable because she can sit down and watch a game and throw back beers with me.
Well, neither is milk because I don't drink milk.
Well, that's, how about some bread?
Okay, bread's fine.
Bread and eggs.
Bread and eggs. I think
but
that's
like,
fair.
But that's the, you know, I don't care if someone's likable and I wish that they would just stop thinking because they really don't. And this is where it is gendered. Other than my sort of, you know, John Kerry example, almost any any allusion to someone being likable, it's always about a woman. And why?
I don't think I don't think it's necessarily just about a woman. I think in the Carrie example I think it's about it's about who is more feminine. Like it's about drawing lines between who is more feminine and who's more masculine. Because John Kerry, like windsurfing and doing rich guy stuff and probably having soft hands, those are things that like Americans would find. I mean, does he?
Yes, Alyssa?
Okay,
that's true.
Thank you.
I mean, they are. Yeah, he takes care of his hands.
Right,
you know?
Right. But I'm saying that when we say likable, it's not, I think it goes beyond just man and woman. It's like masculine, feminine. It's like this person deserves to be the president because he's more manly than the other candidate who we're questioning the likability of. So to question John Kerry was to like feminize him a little bit, I think.
I think that's, you know, that's genius. I had never thought of it that way, but you are 100% right because George Bush was the guy's guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And right now, Donald Trump is a sort of cancerous version of the guy's guy. And so everybody by default is going to be more feminine than him. Thank God, because that is because we deserve to have somebody with more feminine qualities in a position of leadership because men are too emotional to lead. How can regular people ignore the bullshit? And it is really, here's an example of something that kind of distracted me this week. There was some numbers came out about money that was raised by Mayor Pete versus Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris raised $12 million since launching her campaign. Mayor Pete has raised, I believe, $7 million. Both of them are impressive. But a lot of the punditry was celebrating Mayor Pete as somehow besting Kamala Harris. And the way that they talked about it seemed like, wait a second, 12 is bigger than 7. Why is Mayor Pete being celebrated and not Kamala? And why are they being pitted against each other? And it just seemed like on its face, the coverage of it seemed like a Black woman's accomplishments were being painted as lesser than a white man's lesser accomplishments. But Alyssa, you had some nuance to add to that conversation because the way that it was expressed was really clumsy, but it actually got at something that wasn't totally off base.
Correct. And so this is why we all just have to put our little antennae up when we're looking at things. And so my first takeaway when I saw this was like, well, yeah, Kamala announced she was actually running for president in January. She had 20,000 people at her launch event, and her campaign said, you know, 36 hours after the event was over that she had raised $1.5 million. So think about that, like, critically. That was 3 months ago. She had already raised $1.5 million. She seemed like a formidable candidate. Whereas Mayor Pete hasn't even announced he's running yet. His entire campaign had been putting the narrative around him that like Mayor Pete just wants to get on the debate stage. He just wants to clear the hurdle of the DNC, the DNC, what are the qualifications, which was basically that he wanted to get 65,000 unique donors. So yeah, when his number came out, it was like, what the fuck, $7 million?
Right.
Like his campaign did a very good, very, very good job of making the expectations so low and earnest that yes, $7 million. And the reason that as you compare it to Kamala, who, if I'm correct, is the only woman who's released her number yet, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Right. And the only person of color who has released her number is that she actually, people had very high expectations for her because she did so well out of the gate, and $12 million is in fact a tremendous number.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but like, that was my thing, is that like her campaign actually came out with very high expectations 90 days ago. Mm-hmm. And he's been running so like low to the ground and behind the scenes that like, it makes sense that people were like, wow, that was great. But the way that people reported it, the reporters, I think, were a bit ham-handed about the numbers and didn't talk about the facts. So if you're a normal American person and you're watching the news and reporters are like, wow, his number's great, especially when you see Kamala only raised 12, like it's just, it was a not a thorough and intellectual discussion of what the numbers meant.
Well, there's a lot to read. There's a lot to ignore. And there's going to be a lot more to talk about as we plod toward 2020. Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Let's plod. It's our cardio,
let's
girl.
Plod.
Love you.
We're going to plod. Love you. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Stick around. There'll be more hysteria after the break. Welcome back to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan. Joining me for the panel segment of the show this week, we have three wonderful women. We have Dana Schwartz, author of Choose Your Own Disaster, among other things. Dana, here's my question for everybody this week.
Yeah.
When somebody calls you, how do you pick up the phone?
I have now a pat answer that I do force of habit. I just go, hi, this is Dana. Even if it's like seamless calling and I know it's seamless, I always just do, hi, this is Dana.
It's so weird because like I've never heard you say Dana in that tone of voice.
Yeah. And the tone is locked
Dana.
In.
Dana. Mm-hmm. It'll
hi, never.
This is Dana.
Yeah.
It's a song. You could write it as sheet music.
You really could. There's a certain like cadence and pacing to it. I do that every time. I did it like consciously. I was like, I need a way to pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And now I do it every time.
Yeah, I pick it up by, usually if I pick it up, I say, what's wrong? but yeah, my boyfriend's a phone caller person. So I'm used to, so like when he calls, I'm like, hey, you know, like just normal conversation beginnings. But
sometimes if someone's calling, who's like it's like a personal, I'm like, hey, you.
Oh, that's good.
It's just like my awkward, like, why are you calling?
Hey, you. Next, we have actor, comedian, and red checkered shirt wearer who always gets terrible nicknames from me, Karen.
She betrays me. She betrays me every time.
But it is a great red checkered shirt.
It's really nice.
This is going to be our thing. I'm going to like kind of undercut your confidence every single week.
You're razzing me. That's what this female podcast is about.
It's about bringing everybody down a few pegs. I just think
everyone together to bring them down a few pegs.
I think together at the bottom, because that way we're all flying equally high.
Yeah, that's
because it's not happening outside this room.
No. So, Karen, how do you answer the phone when someone calls?
Usually pretty skeptically. It's usually like, I'm usually like, hello. It's usually like, I'm like, I don't have, like, the subtext is whatever you want. I don't have that money. I don't have it. I don't have a debt collector. It's like that.
Hello. Who are you calling for? Who is this?
Not on it. Mm-mm.
And third, and totally not least, actor, comedian, Deandre.
Totally not least.
I was going to say last and not least, and I said third and not least, as though every list only has three items in it. I'm really batting 1,000 today. I've been talking too much this week. Tian, how do you answer the phone?
I know myself, and I'm positive for it, so I usually answer like, hey, hello, hi.
That's so much
do
excitement.
All three.
You're like a like
which
a,
one do you want?
You're like a puppy running to the door when like, you've been gone for 5 minutes. Yeah. I can't wait to see you.
So your subtext is like, oh, you called.
Yes, yes. I'm like,
you called me.
Oh my God, someone's thinking about me.
Mm, that's sweet.
Thank goodness.
That's sweet.
Oh, well, that sounds like a very positive like person to hear on the other end of the phone. So thank you for being the only positive person in this room.
I'll try.
We've just got skepticism and like professional, like cold professionalism.
Cold, distant professional.
Cold, distant professionalism.
Well, she goes up at the end.
Yeah.
So that's this is Dana.
It's like,
it'll be the same
time. I might offer you something. You know what I mean? Upspeak. A little bit of upspeak.
Well, let's get on to the topic of today, which is the amount of emotional and garbage work that women have to do all the time, every day, in all contexts. And by women's work, I don't mean like cleaning, because I mean, whatever, we're not talking about that today. I mean, sort of emotional labor that we always perform in the context of relationships, in conversations. I'm also talking about the type of busy work that we are asked to perform in offices and in professional settings. And I wanted to talk about how that kind of drains us of energy that we could be using for better things. So first of all, I'm going to throw this question to the table. Have you all had a relationship with someone where you felt like you were taking on more work than your partner?
Domestic work, no, because I'm terrible at that, and I'm very messy. And so I do feel like I've been with partners who are slightly neater and will take that on just because they don't want to live
in squalor
with me. But okay. I apologize to everyone I've ever dated. But also, I have noticed that I think in terms of, like, the money and time you take for, like, basic grooming and appearance things, mm-hmm. which is, like, the amount of things that I did fundamentally to look human and, like, acceptable was, like, so many hundreds more dollars and hours of time than whatever they did. Mm-hmm. Where it's, like, I don't think people always understand in a workplace what a woman has to do to look professional.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. And it sort of reminded me of that scene in season one of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel when she goes to bed with her husband with full makeup on.
Yeah.
And then waits until he's asleep and then, like, goes into the bathroom, takes it all off, and then wakes up before him the next morning, puts on a full face of makeup, puts perfume on, and then pretends to be asleep before he wakes up so that he can think that that's how she always looks. And I think that a lot of it is, a lot of the work that women do, I know it's heartbreaking.
Oh my God, that's, yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
Oh my God, straight people make it hard.
But a lot
and
of
I was like, oh, the 50s. Oh.
I mean, but a lot of it, even outside of the context of romantic relationships, a lot of work that women do is sort of like invisible. And sometimes you find yourself, I think women find themselves being accused of or not appreciated as someone that's doing that much work. Kieran, have you had an experience where you felt like you've been carrying the brunt of the emotional workload?
Yeah, I've definitely found myself in a situation where it's like I was like in the kitchen more and, you know, kind of doing the teasing out of what's wrong. But all of those relationships fail mm-hmm. pretty spectacularly. So, you know. Yeah, I think it's interesting to be in a moment where you find it's almost like a frog in water. It's like, and the water gets hotter and hotter, and it's like, so you don't start there, but then there's a certain point where you're like, wait, how did I get here? Like, mm-hmm. why am I like in the kitchen for 2 hours doing a thing while someone else is on the sofa? What am I, my mother?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh. And then you get to a point where you're finally boiling, and you're like, I am not getting hummus for you. And you're like, why are you mad about
yeah,
hummus?
Why
and
you it's mad
like,
about hummus?
No, I'm not mad about hummus. I'm mad about the last 6 months where all I do is get the hummus. You know, it's and it's like it becomes this like blow up over something that seems really trivial, but actually isn't. But just to kind of zoom out into more like friendships mm-hmm. and interactions that are professional. Tian, have you ever found that you have friendships where you are carrying most of the emotional workload?
Yeah, I've had some like creative collaborations that I used to have with like cis straight men that I now no longer have because it reached a point where, you know, it was in the days of like post-college and everyone was trying to do like indie sketch shows. So like you needed to go reach out to a place and like book a theater and do tech and like schedule all of that. And all of that work without fail always fell to the women of the group. Mm-hmm. Like the men would never even think to be like, oh, I'll email the theater and try to set up a tech time. Like, that would have been insane to them to do, for them to do. And so it was like, we were always doing that, the women of the group. There's three of us, and we were always doing that. I hope they're listening. And I know, and now I don't have that partnership anymore because we tried to work on something together, just the two of us, and it turned into, like, me constantly hounding him to meet for... And maybe this is just maybe he was just a bad collaborator, mm-hmm. but constantly hounding him to like show up on time mm-hmm. and like do these things. And I would have to like, instead of him taking the initiative to, you know, reach out to someone, find scheduling, mm-hmm. audition people. Like, I would have to tell him to do that work.
Mm. Right. And, you know, it's interesting. I was listening to a Harvard Business Review podcast yesterday, which is insane. But they have a podcast called Women at Work. And there's a lot of, they have a lot of, like, academics come in and talk about issues like this. And one of the things they were talking about was what's called non-promotable work, which is work that doesn't really show in, it's not really related to the job you're supposed to be doing, and it's not going to get you a promotion. You know, it's the sort of thing like volunteering for a committee, bringing snacks to the meeting, making coffee for everybody. And there's actually been research that has found that women get asked to do volunteer for non-promotable work or expected to do non-promotable work more than men. And women of color especially get asked more to do non-promotable work and to do work that's like busy work and that doesn't lead to many like workplace outcomes. And it takes away energy from, you know, work that you're supposed to be doing.
You know, I find it interesting in a larger conversation about feminism and sexism when people are like, oh, but like not all stereotypes are negative. But there's still this like really pervasive stereotype about women that women are like the competent put together one. Like think about like yogurt commercial women where like the man is like on the couch and he's watching football and he's a slob and doesn't know like what laundry detergent to use. And the wife is like, honey, use Tide or like whatever. Yeah. Like
in a yogurt commercial.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I was like, a yogurt commercial is my life goal. Like I look at those and I'm like,
yeah let's go. Yeah, it's get like
it.
Laundry.
Get it, Greek yogurt. But who's that hot guy? Yeah.
But also it definitely is that Yoplait where like the husband's like looking for dessert and she's on, haven't you seen that one where she's on the phone? She's like, I have banana cream pie. And the husband's like, where? And he like doesn't notice it's yogurt.
This is a husband who can't read. Yeah. Or he's got yogurt blindness.
Yeah.
It's a condition that affects a lot, mostly men. About 2% of the male population actually has yogurt blindness. And it's not funny, Dana. It's not funny. They can't see yogurt in the fridge. They can't read the flavors if they can see it. It's serious.
It's crippling.
Yeah, for you to bring it up is pretty insensitive.
Yeah, really insensitive. Let's hope there are no more listening.
But it's like that stereotype that women are like competent in the ways that men aren't is still like weirdly and pervasively used against women. That it's like, oh, of course you'll be the ones who can like make the arrangements because I'm a dumb guy. I'm just too busy doing like running the whole company.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so dumb that I can only run the whole company.
Yeah.
Like that's the thing that didn't.
I can't make the coffee.
Yeah. I can only make trades on other people's money. Yeah. Like it doesn't make any sense.
Right. That like women are smart enough to like be the only ones who know how to use the coffee machine, but not smart or capable enough to do meaningful work.
Mm-hmm. I've had it where my labor's been incredibly exploited. Like, you know, during a film project or something, it's like just there's an expectation. I think that film can be incredibly exploitative just generally, specifically film. And so it's like, but some of those companies were run by women, you know, so it's like anyone can be a dick.
Mm-hmm. That's true. In this day and age, in this Me Too era, we can all be.
Do you get flashbacks to like fourth grade group projects where like, God bless, like the type A girl who wants an A and just like everyone around her not doing that? Or am I projecting?
No. I was that girl. Yeah. I was just like, ugh, just let me do it.
Yeah, and same.
Like just let me do it. That attitude went all the way into college. I remember I was on my senior year, like Spanish oral exam, the teacher put me with a fucking football player and he was just like not doing anything. And I was like, oh, just let me do it. And that was probably what he wanted to do. Yeah. He was not a dumb guy. He was smart enough to get me to do all the work.
Aaron, you know how to make the coffee. I'm too dumb to figure it out.
You know how to make the coffee en español, por favor. En español.
That's an old Cosby joke that he talks about. Like it's a very famous old bit that he does where his wife asks him to make the breakfast for the kids and he goes down and then he like makes this like, I don't remember what he did. I think he did ice cream. Oh, that's dairy. And he like, he feeds them dessert basically. So they're eating it and they're having such a good time. Then she comes down, she's like, what's going on? And then she sent him back up to bed, which is like exactly where he wanted to be in the first place. Uh-huh. Like delivering incompetency. It's a very funny bit, but it's like, but it's that idea. I feel like my dad will do that, you know? He'll be like, I can't follow the recipe. I'm too dum-dum. It's just like, oh my God.
No, you're not, guys. You're not. You're way less dumb than you're trying to trick us into thinking that you are.
I feel like group projects totally taught me, definitely, as like an overachieving young person, the wrong message, where it was like, if you want a job done right, do it yourself.
Yeah. And then that can lead to a sort of burnout, right? If you're putting all your energy into these things that don't really produce results that are directly related to the work you're supposed to be doing, then you're not able to do your work as well. And that's something that I've found is something I need to consider as I'm like loading my plate with more and more things. If I mm-hmm. spend my time doing stupid emotional labor bullshit, I just can't do it. Like I can't be involved with it at all. I have to just totally cut it off.
And what's with I think another part of emotional labor is the fantasy is that it's also invisible. Mm-hmm. That even compounds the idea that we're not getting credit, where it's like the perfect woman, like the perfect like Stepford woman situation. It's like she's perfectly groomed, perfume, and like her suit is everything's pressed, and like the suit is pressed perfectly, and like breakfast is ready, and coffee mm-hmm. is made, and like everything's done. There's like this facade that it was all just like done by invisible elves and then it was easy. Yeah.
Right. Totally.
So like part of it, it's really insidious that like you don't get credit for it because also part of the work you're doing is making it look like you didn't do anything.
Right. That's an additional layer of work. I was just thinking.
It's like those Cinderella birds.
Yeah.
It's like all those birds and rodents. It's the rodents. A lot of rodents.
Which the mice did it.
Would you let mice do your hair?
I would.
You know, if they were
100%.
If they made it look like that.
Yeah. If they were very
birds,
good at it,
bring
and they
it
like
in.
Yeah,
spiders. I don't give a fuck.
You
don't
let
do
spiders
it.
No, do your hair.
Yeah, well, that's a step too far.
But are they good at it?
If they're good at it,
yeah.
I mean, come on.
Okay, fine.
Like, what about like Charlotte with that web? You know,
oh, you're right.
That
you're
pig.
Right.
Come
and
on
she's
now.
Voiced
you're
by right. Julia Roberts in the new adaptation. Yeah,
I spent
talk about emotional labor. Charlotte just.
Oh my God, that story
is a story of emotional.
Is a story of emotional labor.
Right. She. This spider is.
She dies.
She dies at the end.
She fucking dies for this pig.
Yes, and she works every night to just have like a little fun message that picks up this male pig's confidence. Oh my God.
So he doesn't die. So he does not get slaughtered. And then she's like, yo, I'm really tired. I just got to have these babies now before I die. That's the story.
She does emotional labor for a man, has babies, and dies.
And she's smart enough to spell.
We all that spider.
Oh my God.
We fuck the system.
That story is really weird because why would, even if the web says like, this is some pig, why would anyone still be impressed with the pig and not like, Jesus Christ, that spider can write?
Because that's invisible work.
That's an example of visible work being credited to a man.
Yeah.
We have just totally.
Wow, guys, we have to write this. I think like
this is a
New Yorker shouts piece. Yeah.
This is a think piece.
This is at very least an Insta story. I think.
Okay. Yes.
Insta story, maybe.
No, Aaron, you don't get paid for Insta stories. Write this and submit it to a place that motherfucking pays you for your work.
Oh, they could make a movie called like feminist retelling of children's stories that fucked us up.
Like that would be one.
She did do all the work, though.
She did.
She did the writing, and nobody was ever like, "What a dope spider."
You know,
she also stayed up all night. She would do it. The third.
It's a McSweeney's. It's a McSweeney's piece that's like feminist retelling of childhood.
Okay, well, this has become a writer's room.
Yeah.
But Tian, I was thinking as we were talking about, like, a lot of this is, like, very based on heteronormative and cis concepts of what women are. And it's, they sort of, those ideas haunt all of us. But I wonder how emotional labor plays out in the context of same-sex relationships mm-hmm. between women.
I'm in a really great relationship. I love my girlfriend. No, I'm in a great relationship now where it's been 6 years and we're very good at talking to each other. I could argue that we both do too much emotional labor for each other.
Oh.
Yeah, we're working on our emotions a lot. But in the past, I've had like partners and girlfriends who I have fallen into being, I think because like certain characteristics are tied to certain like femininity and masculinity, and like I maybe the more femme presenting one would take on some like more emotional labor in one particular relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's like it depends. Mm-hmm. Like I think those heteronormative standards still fall on us, and like I know a lot of same-sex couples where the pattern of, like, one who's a bit more, like, one who takes on more masculine traits is the one that's, like, you know, not thinking about the party planning or the cooking or like making sure that everyone's comfortable hosting. Like you can tell, like those characteristics are still very real and gender roles are very pervasive.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so interesting. The same way I think that like my phone voice is just like an imitation of adults that I've heard. Like I do feel like sometimes people like play act at relationships that they see in media or in, and it's sort of like if the wife is the, you know, one cooking and cleaning and is sort of like the sitcom housewife and the husband's always on the couch. Like that's something that people subconsciously or consciously imitate.
Mm-hmm. It's probably also how you grew up, what you saw and what was modeled in your home and then your reaction to it. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you grew like I grew up where my mom did all the work and I was like, that's fucked up. I don't want to do that. So it's like a very conscious, that was a very conscious decision. I do have a friend who's a construction worker, like a really tall, big dude. Wife works for Apple and they're like, so she's in San Francisco a lot of the time. So he has this like truck and then he has this baby and he's always like going to the preschool to pick up the baby. He's always taking the kid to the doctor's office. And he's telling me constantly, there's so much curiosity around him. They're like, who is this guy?
Yeah, somebody's babysitting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a man like, with a child.
It's literally like every day, like people are like, every day he shows up clean. So I guess it's fine. Like people are like, it's like this kind of, it's like, it's still, it's like almost an oddity that he's like such a present dad.
That's such an interesting point that you bring up because I really hate when people describe dads watching their own children as babysitting.
Yes.
It's your child. Nobody is like, mom's babysitting the child now. I think that's another type of labor that women are expected to perform that are just not expected to perform. And that seeps into all these different areas of women's lives. Like professionally, women have a difficult time advancing. Equal pay day is a thing partly because women who have children experience economic consequences because they're expected to care for the children and they are the ones who ask for people at work to allow them to leave early. You know, they're the ones that responsibility falls on, and dads don't experience a similar thing. And I wonder, as like the years have passed, have you guys noticed this improving at all? Or does it seem like it's just the same? Like the Mr. Mom kind of trope.
I feel lucky at my workplace, Entertainment Weekly, we have a lot of women and multiple pregnant women now. And one who just gave birth. So I feel like I'm in a noticeably good environment for women. And like, so that's something that I've clocked where I'm like, oh, this is good. That's great that I have now three women who are superior to me in the workplace who all are publicly young mothers and like talk about their children. And that's something that I hadn't experienced up until now. And I'm like, that's a good thing.
Right.
I get to notice.
Right. Well, it's such a economic, to choose to have children is such an economic decision as well as like a personal decision. Like I'm, you know, working in a writer's room, I'll have like 3 intense months of work where I can't miss any days. I can't call off. I am owned by the show that has hired me. Mm-hmm. That's it. And then I'll have like a few months off and then so it's like, for somebody like me who has like a schedule that's way more permissive than the average American woman and who has a lot more economic freedom and really good WGA insurance, it's like still a fucking hard decision. Like there's part of me that's like, okay, the age I'm at, I should start thinking about this, but it's so, I don't want to be like punished. You know, I don't want people to not want to hire me because it's like, well, she got pregnant the one time, she could do it again, you know? I mean, and it's like, it's a dumb thing to be afraid of, but it is something that crosses my mind for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had so many friends who have had the situation of going to work and being like, when do you tell? Like, when do you tell them that you're pregnant and when will they start taking work away from you? Which is like, it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
Like, they should absolutely still be able to work as much as they want and like make the decisions on when they should stop. Whereas like, yeah, I'll have friends who really just are like, yeah, I'm not going to tell. I'm just going to try to go.
You're just going to show up.
I'm just going
like,
to show up
one day with a baby
and try to get away with it.
I'm just getting fat in this one area of my body.
I love the way if you're growing a person inside of you, I think you should just be able to like chill for 3 years.
Yes.
And like get paid like get paid the whole time you have the child.
Yes.
Then it's like when after your body gets torn apart by that child. And then for like a year or two afterwards is like, you know, just relief, just fucking relief for continuing the human race.
Yes.
Am I the only one who thinks this way? I don't feel like this is an extreme perspective and there's a lot of silence in this room.
I think American society is depressingly far from being there.
Yeah.
Like, I think we would all love for that to happen. But like, I'm just imagining if like a presidential candidate for 2020 were like, let's get fucking Scandinavian, guys. Like,
need maternity leave
for like a year.
Yeah, we're one of three countries in the entire world that doesn't offer government sanctioned paid maternity leave. Like, what the fuck?
And that's bad for young families. That's bad for men and young parents, just young parents in general, because of because this is another thing I was thinking about with emotional labor. It's like, if you have a community, like now American society is so individualistic, like you don't live close to your, I mean, maybe some people do still, but it's like I don't live close to my parents. Whereas like, imagine if you live close to your parents and you have children, then it's like you have free babysitters. Do you know what I mean? Who are like so excited to see your family. Like, so if you live in an extended family situation, it's like, then somebody can do the cooking, somebody can do the cleaning. It's like a little bit more of like, you can toss the baby around like a football. You know what I mean? Like, that's what you do you have, you know, an extended family situation. And then it's a little bit more of, people were meant to live in communities, you know? So it's like, one of the things I think about sometimes with like immigrants, it's like, in India, it was like a much bigger extended family situation. So it's like, even if women did all the work, or like when my mother moved to England, all the kids did all the work, it was still like three or four sisters. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In a big situation. So the mom comes home, my grandmother would come home and it was like, she had tea made for her. She took a nap or whatever. Mm-hmm. But when my mom moved to Florida, it's just the three of us. It's just my dad, my mom, and me. And so she ends up doing like all of that labor herself, because I guess I was very lazy. As I'm talking, I'm like, realization.
I am the one at fault.
I am a monster. Okay, cool.
Well, that's a really great point, I think, that people used to live in bigger extended family situations in the U.S. and in other parts of the world, people still do. And that gave me an idea. I think we need to make a Tinder for extended families. So just hear me out.
I thought you were going back to commune on the lake.
No.
We talked about your commune on the lake one time.
It's women only commune on the lake, 100%. Yeah. But I think for people in big cities, like there are plenty of people who are like empty nesters whose kids moved away, who don't really come back and hang out. And there are us who moved here who aren't anywhere near our family. So what we need
That's actually a really good idea.
A Tinder for like empty nesters who are like, I really want to have somebody over for Sunday dinner.
And a Tinder for family.
Family Tinder. Family Tinder.
Finder?
That sounds really bad.
I bet if we Urban Dictionary that we would find something.
That's when like someone fingers you and fucks up and I got findered and I missed all the holes.
It's a Me Too extension.
Yeah. Oh God. This was so wholesome.
And
then it became HOLE-some. Wholesome.
Don't say findered.
I won't. I will never say that word again. But I think like
Family Tinder.
Yes.
Yeah. Family Tinder.
Name TBD.
Yes, exactly.
You know, this is not like childcare, but there is that thing where young people who like graduate from college who are like don't have a lot of income live in old like retirement homes and communities because it's cheap and like there's all the facilities there, and like old people need young energy to like keep it live and you know, lively, and young people get to like live there like either free or super super cheap, and it's like a good like communal.
Have you done that?
No.
Oh,
I didn't know it exists.
Well, I think like that brings up a really interesting point. Like, I love old people. Elderly women and emotional labor is a really interesting topic, too, because elderly women grew up in a time where even more was expected of them and they were less allowed to express themselves in their own needs. And so I think it's interesting that there are these, you know, there are communities of people now who kind of don't have anybody to do things for. And I think that is an important, it brings up an important point, which is that if you have an opportunity to like hang out with elderly women who are not related to you, do it, because they're they're awesome and they're super fun. If you have a nursing home in your town, you can go talk to a volunteer coordinator and ask if there's somebody who like has, you know, can't really see anymore and wants somebody to read to them. Like I used to work in a nursing home when I was in high school and they and college, and they they're just the best. And that's like one way to sort of, you can do emotional labor for somebody who is kind of already paid into the emotional labor bank.
Pay it back, invest.
Emotional labor socialism.
Right, exactly.
It's and social security, it's going to run dry. There won't be enough for all of us.
Totally. So what is something, what's something that we as women can do to interfere with the cycle of us performing emotional labor and rechanneling our energy into something that's more worthwhile? What's something that, and here's something that I will say, just I'll answer my own question. I think something that's really important is that if you are, if you're somebody that's doing things a lot for somebody and you don't think that they know, just tell them. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that like keeping things secret and silent is just it's burdening you. It's bringing the temperature of the water up. So you, the frog, are getting closer and closer to boiling. Mm. I think the best thing that you can do is just be open about the fact that you're frustrated or you feel as though you're doing more than you should be doing. Whether or not that's at work, you can just take your boss aside and be like, look, you know, I volunteered for a lot of these committees, or you've asked me to do this a lot. And I would just like maybe next time to have somebody else do it, just because I've been doing it a lot. You know, I have a lot of important work. I would like to do that. So that's my advice.
Yeah, I would say something similar, which is that like if you think the illusion of it being invisible is part of the gift that you're giving, you can fix that. Mm-hmm. You don't need to hide the work. You don't need to like be a duck mm-hmm. where it's like smooth on the surface and working really hard underneath. I think that's a fantasy that a lot of women want to play into.
Ducks are fantasies?
Yeah.
What?
Swan.
That's crazy.
But right, I think that's a great analogy.
Yeah. Myth-busting today. No, I'm just
I'm like,
very
I don't
animal
know.
Heavy.
Well, then yeah, I realized, I was like, I don't know that much about like duck anatomy.
No,
like,
they are doing a ton of work.
Yeah, they're doing a ton of work.
So like if that's part of the fantasy, you can dispel that. And also just then like fight your instinct. Where if I know a lot of women, me included, are perfectionists and like want, if they're like, oh, well, the coffee hasn't been made yet, or like some little task hasn't been done yet, you can just like fight that and have your internal temperature rise slightly and get used to it a little bit and be okay with things being imperfect mm-hmm. and not doing that thing.
Okay. Karen, how about you?
You can be the one to play dumb.
Oh! Yes. Be an idiot. That's Karen's advice.
Be dumber. Try less hard, or be like, what? I don't get it. And then somebody will just be like, well, I'll do it. Blah. Like you with cleaning.
Yeah.
You're kind of doing
Except
it.
Except like, I really don't play dumb. I don't have an iron.
Right. But I'm saying you were you're very messy.
Yeah.
But it's like technically you could be not messy.
Yeah. I think then it plays back into what I'm saying. It's like, I don't mind my clothes on the floor.
Right.
And so it's like, well, if you mind, like you can clean.
Yeah. So that's a little bit of exactly what I'm talking about. You're like, well, yeah.
Yeah. I can't see. I'm clothes blind. I can't
yeah,
see.
I'm yeah. Clothes blind. I can't read them.
Yeah. All right. Tian, what do you think?
I would say that if you can and you have the ability to surround yourself with people who appreciate that work and who also take on some of that work,
sure.
Yeah.
Then you can start to like spread out the emotional labor that mm-hmm. is passed around. Like I feel very lucky and blessed that like most of the folks that I've, I now exclusively am friends with women and queer women. Or those are the people that I hang out with the most. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be that like, it's the most nurturing and also satisfying, less toxic relationship mm-hmm. is because I'm surrounded by people who are thinking about that work as not being invisible. And we're like very thankful for each other and showing appreciation. Mm-hmm. So if you can, show yourself.
And that can come in any relationship.
Yeah.
It's like, and I think you can improve upon that. And that was probably better advice than playing dumb.
And that's another tip that I want to add in and piggyback on is like then thank the people in your yeah. life for doing the labor, because there's a lot of people doing labor that probably isn't being noticed, and it's on all of us to be like, hey, you did that. Yeah. Thank you. Great job.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do want to say that I think that while boys and men are socialized to perform less emotional labor, I think that I've seen that there's a certain group of men, there's some men who really want to do better mm-hmm. and that are trying. Like, we get emails from male listeners all the time, like dads and people that are just like, yeah. Oh, it's cool. And it's like, you know, I think that if you're a man and you're listening, you know, this isn't this isn't us like scolding you. This is us just being like, you can be better, you know, yeah. and notice the things that the women around you are doing and appreciate the things that the women around you are doing. And if you notice that there's something that can be done, then try doing it yourself and see how that feels. It actually might feel good to like do something for other people if that's not typically what you do. So unfortunately, that is all the time we have for this conversation. We have to take a break. When we come back, the hills that we will die on. And welcome back to More Hysteria. We've reached the end of the show almost. This is the part where we take adamant stances on things that don't really matter. The hills will die on. Let's get started with a listener hill.
Hi, Hysteria. This is Sarah from San Antonio, Texas. The hill that I will die on is when you make a plan with someone and then they show up super early and text you and say, hey, I'm here, as though you should also magically be there. If we say, let's meet at 7 and you show up at 6:30 and text me that you are there, I should not have to feel bad that I am not also there because we said 7. So show up on time, or if you get there early, read a fucking book or something. Yeah. That is my hill.
A lot of nods around the table for that one, Sarah. Everybody seemed pretty much on that hill.
I'm the person who always shows up early. I'm just a pathologically early person to plans usually. And I will say, usually I do have a book and I don't mind. I just want to let you know that in case you were like, oh, well, I don't want to be too early, I'll circle the block a few times. Uh-huh. I'm just texting you to let you know, but no pressure. Don't worry. I do have a book.
Oh, Dana, well, you and Sarah maybe would not be compatible as hangout pals. Okay, who wants to go first this week? I'm not going to do it because mine's stupid.
Mine is so stupid that I'm going to start because okay, I can't follow like any serious one. Mine is about a movie. The movie is The Nightmare Before Christmas. And my hill is that the couple, Jack and Sally, are terrible. And people pretend it's a love story. And I just don't understand it fundamentally. It really confuses me and weirds me out. In case you're not familiar, the movie is about a skeleton pumpkin king named Jack Skellington, who wants to experience the joy of Christmas.
Because he's a puppet one? The Tim Burton
puppet?
It's
claymation.
Yeah.
And he accidentally sees Christmas and is like, what is this joy? I want to experience it for myself. So he tries to culturally appropriate Christmas. And he kidnaps Santa and tries to become Santa. It spectacularly goes up in flames. And the only person who saw that coming is like a Frankenstein woman named Sally, who's in love with him this whole time. He ignores her this whole time. And then after he's exploded and like literally bombed down by the government it's a really weird movie for ruining Christmas. He is like, I shouldn't have done Christmas. You were right. Also, I love you. Also, we're a couple now and we're perfect together. And the last song is a love song. And I'm like, Jesus Christ. And like Hot Topic teams like who love My Chemical Romance, like also are like, yeah, Jack and Sally, like my love story, like couples like think it's cute. But like, no, he ignores her the entire time. She warns him that this Christmas is a bad idea. He, like, fully is like, yeah, whatever. They never have a conversation. She pines after him. And then finally at the end, he's like, yes, I love you. And so it's nice that, like, a weird quiet girl who was in love with, like, the popular jock boy does get, like, the boy to love her. But they are a terrible couple. And nowhere in the movie do they, like, have a love story at all. Mm-hmm. And it's really weird to me that this love story exists. And I just, whenever I see, like goth couples who are, like, into that, it makes me really uncomfortable. Not because you're goth. Like, be goth. That's great. I love My Chemical Romance. Just don't like Jack and Sally as a couple.
My favorite thing about The Nightmare Before Christmas, I love that movie, even though, I have to not think. It's one of those movies you have to not think about it.
It's aesthetically really like fun.
The music is fun. And one of my favorite things to do around the holiday season is to talk like I'm in the movie and like, look at me, I'm grocery shopping. Like, narrate my life in the Jack Skellington voice. You guys are, you know, you're welcome for not doing that at all over Christmas this year, because I do that a lot.
I feel like I just got, like, I have to, like, the color has to, like, I have to, the blood has, I got really heated. I didn't expect sucks to get so passionate.
I mean, I would go one step further and just like all cartoons and all those films don't need love interests.
Yeah.
They simply don't need them. They could just be friends. It makes me so mad when like children's, I don't think Nightmare Before Christmas is a children's film, but it's like a younger film.
Yeah, true.
And I don't think you need, like, I just watched Wreck-It Ralph for the first time. Don't ask me why.
Is there a love story in that?
Yeah, there is. There is like a really bizarre forced one between Jack McBrayer's character and Jane Lynch's character.
Weird.
The tiny hammer guy.
And the tough lady.
And they just force this romantic relationship between them. And it's completely unnecessary.
Yeah.
So
People like love.
Well, I will say the better
hammers.
I really like the movie Corpse Bride, another Tim Burton stop motion. And that one has a love story, but it like makes sense. Like they're on equal footing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you want a love story, go to Corpse Bride. No one does. Everyone goes to Nightmare Before Christmas.
Corpse Bride.
Not a love story.
Corpse Bride.
Yeah. Hmm.
Good advice. I will be watching Corpse. I will not be watching Corpse.
Watch Corpse Friend, you guys.
Speaking of corpses, I'll go next. So I was walking around my neighborhood earlier this week, and I crossed the street without looking, and I almost got hit by a car. And I looked, and it was a smart car. And my first thought was, like, that would have been humiliating. Like, imagine if I had just gotten, like, I'm just imagining my, like, wrecked body being just slammed by a smart car. A, it would have been my fault for not looking. B, it would have been, like, it would have humiliated this, like, poor smart car driver who's probably a good person, just, like, trying to, like, have as little impact on the environment as possible. And third, like, I'm imagining being in, like, in a fucking hospital with, like, tubes going into me and stuff. And being like, yeah, a smart car did this to me. How embarrassing. I hope that if I ever get hit by a car, it is a giant truck and not a smart car.
So your hill is, you shouldn't get hit by a smart car.
I just think it would be very embarrassing if you got hit by a smart car. That's my hill. I will literally, I won't even die on it. It won't even be strong enough to kill me, this hill.
Well, if you die on it, we hope it wasn't by a smart car.
Yes, exactly. So that's my hill. I told you it was dumb. It was really dumb. Okay, anyway, Tian, do you want to go?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'll go. Since we were talking about couples, the hill that I will die on is that I really dislike and I really hate when couples Facebook post each other, like put right?
Oh, yeah.
I really don't like when couples communicate via social media.
Oh, I hate it.
In a very specific, like I'll have one person who, I think this is a personal pet peeve, who their boyfriend will comment on one of my photos and they will only like the boyfriend's comment and ignore the post. Which is
that's funny.
Kick me out of your foreplay.
I know. I'm like, this is...
Oh, it's so weird.
I don't want to be a part of this. This is some gross, weird... You're right. It is some gross, weird foreplay that I'm witness to on my post. I don't like it. I don't like when, like...
You should reply and be like, don't put this on me. Don't put this on me.
Don't put this emotional labor on me.
My favorite way to respond to, like, dumbass social media posts is just the word unsubscribe.
I should start doing that.
Or if
that.
There's, like, a back and forth in my Twitter mentions, not between romantic people, if people are, like, having some pedantic argument, I just respond to all. I'm like, unsubscribe. And then I mute the conversation.
I mean, I'm not going as far as saying, like, if your significant other posts something and you want to, like, post something cute underneath it, that's fine. But don't have it play out on someone else's social media presence.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. All right. Kieran, how about you?
Well, Dana, you inspired me. I was going to say, I didn't like Edward Scissorhands.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw it as a child. I don't like that film. I don't like the film. I don't like Johnny Depp because of this movie.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
You don't like Johnny Depp because of the movie?
Well, no, yes, I think I've never liked Johnny Depp.
That's very dated the other reasons.
Yeah, I mean, there's other reasons now. Yeah. But, like, I was like, well, he kind of won me back when he was that weird pirate man. But then it was like,
It's a fun movie.
I saw Edward Scissorhands when I was quite young, and I don't think I was ready for it. Mm-hmm. And I had nightmares about it. And I was like, and all I can remember to this day is like, I was like, why don't they just give this guy hands? He's got scissors for hands.
Vincent Price died.
I know.
On the
I was so I can still remember being so incredibly stressed out.
He was hit by a smart car. The entire thing.
I remember being like, why can't they just need to give this guy hands and find this old man? And I was like, thank God. And then he died, and I was like, what is this? This is a nightmare. This is a nightmare. Oh, that's it.
Well, if it were Edward Regular Hands, it wouldn't be a movie.
Yeah.
Edward Regular. What did you call it?
What the fuck? What is? I don't know, man. What? Come on, man. How is that? With scissors for hands?
Yeah.
It's insane. How did you sell that movie?
Yeah.
Why? And then he'll have scissors for hands? Yeah. I hate that film.
It sounds like something that a person who had taken some mushrooms and wandered around Joshua Tree came up with. They were like, oh, a movie about a guy with scissor hands, because they were looking at the trees and it looks like the trees are made of scissors. Anyway, that's how I think that movie happened.
He'd probably Finder you. Who would? Edward Scissorhands.
That's what a Finder is.
Good callback. Good, terrible callback. That's all the time we have for this week. Thank you, Tien, Dana, and Kieran. And thanks to Alyssa Mastromonaco for calling in to talk about likability. And there will be more Hysteria for you next week. I am from another planet. This nation, fuck Janet. With these girls, gonna fan it. 1-2-K, email, and scan it. Don't take no for an answer. Girl with a map that's overdone. Right, cause girls just wanna have fun. So Annie, get your gun. Give them a